And welcome to True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. This is Kevin, your host. True Wealth is, and always will be, hopefully, brought to you by Coins Plus in Spokane, Washington. Coins Plus is your full-service rare coin and precious metals broker-dealer depository service. We're always in the business of buying and selling precious metals, gold, silver, scrap gold, jewelry, diamonds, rare coins, collectibles, estates, jewelry, lots of little expensive things that are biblically endorsed and authorized as True Wealth. I've mentioned in the past, I also collect tactical weapons. As a collector, I must reiterate, not as a dealer. I never resell them. I have to say that because if I did, it'd be a bad thing because you need a license to do that, and I don't do that. But I do trade occasionally for good tactical military weapons, you know, tactical defense weapons. I don't like junk. I like good quality. And I like good, you know, accurate stuff. There's some guns out there that you just need to know how to look at them. And I have a fairly decent knowledge, but I have an employee that was a federal firearms license dealer for 17 years who can look at them. And recently we had a gun come in that looked like a good brand. And we noticed upon further inspection, the barrel had been changed out for a different barrel, which obviously affected the value. But I do collect tactical weapons. I have quite the gun collection. Personally, I'm not really into old stuff. I'd probably be interested in some really, really, really old stuff. Like, there's some interesting old guns out there that, like a Sharps rifle and things like that I had and have and, you know, stuff like that. But anyway, if you have good quality tactical weaponry or good quality tactical pistols, semi-automatics and stuff for trade, I'm interested in that. Just to throw that out there. And again, as a collector, Coins Plus can be reached 444-0044 in Spokane. Toll free outside the area, 877-TAP-COIN, 877-827-2646, or through the website at coinsplus.com. We could, you know, harp on the political stuff of the day and, you know, Trump getting beat up and, you know, whatever else is going on. There's all kinds of it every day, isn't there? I don't think I'm going to do that today. I've got all kinds of stuff in front of me here. One thing that I think I probably should do that I haven't done for quite a while. Wow, there's just so many things I've got staring me in the eye. I've got some really neat stuff on the Bill of Rights. And I've been doing a lot of research lately on our founding fathers. And, you know, the absolute deep Christian roots there. I did apparently have a family member I found out that I offended. They listened to my radio show and didn't like something I said about something that apparently conflicted with their beliefs. I think what's important, folks, is to be able to have civil dialogue, to be able to respect other opinions openly. You know, I say things I'm sure you don't agree with. I get people that disagree with all kinds of things, or they misunderstand my views. I have some very non-conforming self-constructed views that are my own that may look and sound a lot like other views. Sometimes people will mistake them for, like my sincere belief that when you put together all of the Jewish writings that say that we're not the first of earthly worlds created, that God created many before us, but we're the first where he combined his mercy. A good friend of mine who had a huge impact on me coming to the Lord early in my life in college, we were talking and, you know, he just didn't like that theory. He says that's gap theory, and it's not gap theory. Gap theory means that God is the God of the gaps. It means that God is, that evolution is true and that God just works in the gaps, which just doesn't make any sense. What it means, and then his whole debate with that was, with my theory that God's had human-style free will creations before us that failed, was like, oh, then God made a mistake. That can't be real. God didn't make a mistake. God's God. We're not. If you want to argue that God made a mistake, look at the destruction of mankind at the flood of Noah. God didn't make a mistake. We did. I believe, you know, God's got a grander plan than we do. God could easily create free will beings and give them the opportunity to choose redemption or whatever it may be. And then, you know, destroy their physical existence because it, you know, they didn't choose properly. That's exactly what happened at the flood of Noah. It doesn't mean that God failed. It just means that he had other plans. And then the argument was, well, that means he's a developmental God, that he changes and develops. Well, yes and no. God does sort of develop. I mean, over time, God introduced the Ten Commandments to Moses after years and years in captivity. You know, he's not developing himself, but his revelation to us is always developing. And he's giving us, you know, he's given us more information as time has gone on. And, you know, why? I don't know. Maybe to alter or not alter the course of history, to affect things, to keep them going the way he wants them to go. I mean, it blows people's mind that God would be a conscious thinking free will, you know, divinity. That it's more like they just want this force that just sits in a chair with just utter simplicity. I don't see God that way at all. I see God, if God gave us these great minds and great flexibility in thinking and the ability to create, why would he not be even more so that way? And so he's going to, you know, reveal to us more and more. But with Christ, he gave us his son to be redeemed so we can finally make it. That's why the Bible says that the hosts of heaven cried out when they exalted God when they saw the creation of mankind. They were stoked. They were happy. Then something happened that made Lucifer so mad, he chose to fall from heaven and take a third of the angels with him. What was that? It was, I believe, the knowledge that this creation of mankind is different. I'm going to give them my son to pay for their sins. They're going to make it to heaven. They're going to share in heaven with the angels. They're going to even judge the angels. He's made us greater than the angels. That made Lucifer livid. Lucifer was the highest creation being below God. And now God's saying, these beings that I'm creating are going to rule over you. They're going to judge you in eternity. And then a war breaks out in the heavens. And something happens. There's multiple references in the Old Testament to the destruction of Rahab, which is not well explained. But it does appear to be the habitation place of Lucifer. Which would explain the asteroid belt. I love scientists that say, well, the asteroid belt just could not quite be as big of a planet as theory says, because there's only 15% of the necessary matter in the asteroid belt in order to, you know, to create a planet that size. Well, it's pretty obvious we've got all kinds of signs of cataclysmic events. Mars, our moon, you know, craters everywhere. And obviously that if a planet exploded, it'd blow in 360, you know, 3D degrees, and only a certain amount would be left in orbit. Really dumb arguments. But somehow Lucifer was ejected from his place in the heavens and cast down to earth for a period of time. His light was removed from him. So he's on a different dimension that we can't view, but he can interact and impact our lives somehow, and his demons or whatever. So all this stuff is, you know, it's interesting. It's not necessary knowledge, but it's important to understand, as I say, and some people don't like the saying, but the Bible is sufficient, but it's not complete. God doesn't tell us everything in the Bible. Not even close. And that bothers some people. They think it's fully complete. They think the cannons are completely accurate. That's an inaccuracy for the simple fact that the cannons were created before the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we resurrected books like 1 Enoch, which was, at the time of Christ, the most readily carried book of the Bible. You got to be really careful because there's other false books of Enoch floating around out there that purport to be it, but they're not. They're deceptive and so on and so forth. The canons used a series of litmus tests to determine what went into it, but there's many books I've studied that made it through the first 20 canons and not the 21st. And, you know, if the canons are so accurate, why would that be? And, you know, they got to the point where it became subjective. It became, you know, quote, led by the Spirit. Some of the criteria was rejected, like the fact that if a book is mentioned in another inspired book, it's inspired. Well, the book of Enoch is quoted in the book of Jude completely. So it's just interesting. And then the argument is, well, then that other book was written later. Well, not if it was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's just one argument, one debate that people really struggle with. Isaiah 45:7, where it says God creates evil. That blows people's minds. They don't like that. It's very interesting how much that bothers people that God could create evil. But how could he create? And then here's the other thing. So you go to the Isaiah 45:7, and now, you know, like NASB, they say the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity, they say. But the words for well-being are, where it says well-being, the word is shalom, shalom, good, right? Shalom, shalom. It's the word for good. And then they have the word ra for calamity. It's evil, good and evil. It's the same word that's used in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God, it says that. But the translators go pollute it and clean it up because they don't like that concept that God created evil. Well, how could he create the tree of the good and evil without creating evil? So, just some things to think about. That's stuff that, you know, I've been having conversations with people about lately, and it sounds a little bit deep. People get a little bit crazy. It's outside of what I call theological necessity, which is the Apostles' Creed. But it's important to understand God's so much bigger than we want him to be. And I don't understand how you can put your faith in a God that has all these limitations and, you know, and because we can't philosophically comprehend something, he couldn't do it. And those thought processes, just you're not letting your mind expand wide enough. I mean, not that you could ever comprehend it fully, but you can comprehend that you can't comprehend it. You can at least go to that point, right? So you got, and I really believe, how big is your God, they say? Well, how big can you pray if your God's in a little box? If you think small and you think limited, I've had situations I may have discussed before, an individual who went into business in a similar business as mine about the same time, and he took over an existing business. He was doing better than I was considerably, and you know, made sure I knew it. And then over time, God began to bless our business, and he had some struggles, and we've all had them, obviously. And I encouraged him to pray about the business, and then I spoke with him, you know, and he felt that he just didn't feel right praying about money. And I spoke with him three or four weeks later, said, "How are things going?" Anyway, he didn't feel comfortable praying about money. We discussed it. I said, "Look, God's got to be involved with everything in your life." So he finally prayed about it, and then a few weeks later, his business was doing better than it ever has, and I said, "That's because you're praying about that." And then a while later, he was back in the dumps, and I said, "Are you still praying?" He said, "No, I still don't feel comfortable praying about money." We can't just let God into certain areas of our lives. If you have convinced yourself that it's wrong to pray about money, the love of money is the root of all evil, folks. Money itself is this inculcated, integrated piece of your life. It's an absolute part of who we are on this earth. I can't tell you why. It's not a random coincidence created by man. It gets the knowledge of it pops up in Genesis 2:11. As I always say, you know, Genesis 1, God creates the heavens and the earth and everything that's in them. And by Genesis 2, he's telling us about gold and where to get it. And he says it's good. And he gives us the highest Hebrew compliment word possible, tov. Money makes the world go round, as they say. My mom used to always say that. I mean, it sounds bad, but it's part of who we are. I can't explain to you why God did what he did, but I know that it's a huge part of who we are. Two-thirds, depending on how you perceive it, two-thirds to 75% of Christ's sermons, or I'm sorry, parables, deal with money. It's a huge thing. It's a big deal. Money is something that you have to deal with. Money reflects your self-discipline. Money reflects your heart condition. Money, you know, it reflects your work ethic. It reflects your integrity. It reflects everything. It reflects, you know, what you spend it on, says what's important to you. It's everything. It's a huge part of who we are. It's like people say, you know, money isn't everything, but poverty is terrible, right? I mean, it's just tough. Poverty sucks. I mean, and trust me, I am the last guy to sit here and be preaching health and wealth to you at all. Not even there. We have to be content with whatever God gives us. But we can't lie and make mistakes and curse our own lives with bad decisions and then say that's the way God wants it. I don't believe God is, you know, as many of these traveling preachers will preach, that God wants you rich and happy and healthy and all that. Well, he does, but he wants you to be in line with him. It's not, he doesn't want everybody. In other words, as it says, do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for a man shall sow, or whatever a man reaps, that he shall also sow. So if if you're reaping into the Lord, you're living for the Lord, then he'll bless you. But if you're reaping towards the flesh, as it says, you're going to reap corruption. So, you know, it's not only God's will that good comes to you, but it's God's natural law that if you live your life a certain way over time, good things come. But a lot of that's visible. A lot of it seems supernatural, but it's not. If you're a super good employee, I know a guy who I spoke to many, many years ago who was, you know, he was not doing well. He was just flat broke, living it poor, poor, poor. And I told him, he's like, what's the secret to success? I said, the secret of success is you get up every day, you work your butt off. I said, you respect your anybody who's in authority over you with kindness. You respect your coworkers. I said, you always offer. You have a servant's heart, servant leadership. You always step up and take care of other people around you. You don't grumble or gripe about if it's your job or not your job. You do everything you can. You dress nicer than everybody at work. You show up before everybody gets there and you leave after everybody gets there. And you act like you own the place with respect and with pride. And this person took my advice. It's been a number of years. I would say that was probably in the late 90s. He actually started out in the janitorial staff of a hospital, and he worked his way up and up and up into a supervisory position, and then he was able to use that to get a position with a huge hospital in a big city, and now somehow he ended up being he worked his way up over the last 17 years. He's the supervisor of maintenance for a massive hospital, and he's making a tremendous amount of money. His wife and kids are living really well. I mean, he literally started out at minimum wage, and 17 years ago, and the last time I talked to him, he was making like $135,000 a year. And he just thanks me all the time. And I said, no, thank God, because those are his principles. I'm not saying that, you know, that it has anything to do with me. I'm just saying that God's principles are true, tried and true. I could just tell stories all day. I was around a guy here a little while ago that should have been doing certain chores around his house. And I said, hey, why don't you take the garbage out for her? And he goes, no, that's her job. And I'm like, no, it's not. Our job is, as husbands, is to be servants to our wives. It's to be servant leaders to anybody. Nothing is beneath us. When Jesus washed his disciples' feet, folks, feet are dirty and stinky, especially back then. There was dust and dirt. They didn't have paved roads everywhere. Jesus lowered himself to the lowest level because he was saying, to express my love for you, I must serve you. And that is what we need to show the world. Servant leadership. And so, boy, how many times do we get puffed up with pride and arrogance and say, how dare you treat me like that? How dare you talk to me like that? I was here first. Who cut in front of me in line? Or, you know, whatever it may be, that is not the spirit that reflects God. That's the spirit the world's used to seeing. And when you behave that way, they're never going to look and say, wow, there's something different about that person. And the world, you know, I was through a mutual friend, he was showing me some, I don't know quite how to say it without revealing too much, but a guy who is a massive motivational speaker, and I met Tony Robbins, who was a big, you know, who kind of created motivational speaking in the 90s when I was kind of coming up in life. Tony Robbins would key off on you becoming your very best, okay? No matter what that was. Then there's this other guy that a friend of mine does a ton of work for, and he was like, oh, you don't know him? And I'm like, no. So he showed me a picture of him. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know him. I met him. And the guy's gone from, you know, being a nice-looking professional guy to being all buffed out on steroids, obviously, in his 40s. And his wife was very beautiful, and now she's got, you know, so much plastic surgery. It's terrible. But the thing is this guy does all this motivational speaking, and so he popped open a YouTube video to show me this guy's work. And this guy, years back, he started a huge company that did really well, and he always gave the glory to the Lord. He just was about God, and he spoke the right things all the time. And now he's, you know, on his Learjet, and he's taking pictures of his jet and saying, if you want to have a jet like I do, and you want to fly around in a private jet, you know, you need to do what I tell you. And if you want to have all these boats and all these cars, and it's become just complete and total materialism. That is the lust of the flesh. Do not get caught up in that. The Bible says clearly, if you want money, if you desire money or you lust after it or covet it, it will get wings and fly away. It will never be enough. You'll chase it your whole life. You'll kill yourself chasing it. What blows my mind is when people will sell their soul for something they never get. What's different is you'll see people literally sell out for something they never get. And then on the other hand, you'll see people like rock stars that literally, I believe, the devil makes a covenant with them. He says, okay, I'm going to give you all this glory and all this fame and all this wealth. And then I'm going to take your life young. I'm going to take it early. And then I'm going to have you for eternity. So I'm going to give you a taste of what the earth has to offer. But if it doesn't come from God, it's a nasty taste. It's bitter wormwood, as the Revelation calls it. And I believe that takes place. They're one of the few that actually get to, you know, that sell their soul for something physical. And it's even a worse byproduct than those who sell their soul for the fantasy of something, if that makes any sense to you. So anyway, let's balance a few things. You know, I talked briefly, I guess let's do this real quick. I talked briefly a minute ago about all the different theories of evolution and of what the impacts of all that are. And I'm going to see if I can find this here. I seem to be bouncing around on this. Let's talk about theistic evolution real quick. When people embrace evolution and say, no, yeah, evolution's real. It's just God did it. You need to understand there is creation or there is evolution. The two do not come hand in hand. Evolution is where something creates something else out of itself, completely contrary to the laws of nature and physics. Okay, that's what evolution is. Evolution is pure foolishness. It's pure idiocy. It's absolute, you know, it's completely contrary to all of the laws of physics. It's lunacy. It is foolishness. So when you hear the word evolution, I want you to just always think lunacy. It's like, oh, that's the theory of lunacy. It's the theory of stupidity. Why it's easier for somebody to think that a rock created an elephant than a god created the rock and the elephant, I don't get, okay? It just makes no sense. And so it's kind of like the whole story where these scientists, you know, in the way in the future started to get so good, you know, at the one thing you'll never see science do is create life. But in the future, they say there was a, you know, it's a story, but you know, it got to the point where these scientists got so good that they could create life, and they had basically a situation with God where he says, no, you can't. And they said, yeah, we can. So they kind of had a competition where they said, okay, you create your life, I'll create mine. Well, God did all these wondrous, magnificent things, and he showed all these things he created. And when it was these scientists' turn, they reached down and started to gather all this dirt and all this other stuff to create life. And he says, no, you need to bring your own dirt, you know. And, I mean, basically, we have to realize God's the creator of everything. No matter what we do as mankind, it's we're doing it with what he gave us. When we're really impressed with technology, which is getting pretty impressive, to be honest with you, we're only tweaking this magnificent world that God gave us to tweak. We live in a world with magnetism and electricity and water and all kinds of incredible power and phenomenal life and all these insects that and herbs and plants that create all kinds of biochemicals. And, you know, we live in such an absolute fervor of life. It's unbelievable. So we just need to realize that all we're learning to do is tweak some of the stuff God gave us. And what's interesting about that is he intended it that way. He intended us to do amazing things. One thing, I guess, another quick bounce is we've seen Black Lives Matter kind of die down a little bit. Recently, it's gotten a little bit quieter. A conversation I was having with someone here a while ago that's very interesting is people, you know, the police state is becoming very true, okay? It's just that I think the Black Lives Matter doesn't always pick the right battles. I think they've got really good battles, and I think there's definitely racism out there and all that stuff. But I think the great issue is the fact that the police state is threatening us. And by creating division between black and white and red and blue, in other words, Democrat and Republican, and man and woman and gay and straight, all that division prevents the unity from us being able to stand up against our government when they become tyrannical, which is what, you know, our founding fathers' entire existence was to rebel and protect us against the tyranny of government. Now, one thing that's interesting, when Black Lives Matter is so angry at the government and the United States, you know, they'll bring up the fact that they were used as slaves and things, okay? But here's the part where I deviate. Slavery existed. Slavery was in the Bible. People will say, oh, the Bible's an archaic book. It encourages slavery. No, the Bible reflected the culture of the day, and it told those who were slaves how to respond, because Christ came to allow us. First, he came as a suffering lamb. You know, he came to sacrifice himself. and he taught us how to teach the world love. The second time he comes as a conquering king, that's different. But a book that would encourage an uprising of slaves would encourage their death and demise, and it, you know, wouldn't work. And it just wasn't the right thing. So it was a situation where they taught love and so on and so forth. So when people say the Bible encourages slavery, that's not accurate. It reflects society. The point that I'm making on this is simple. America is the nation that stopped slavery. Now, I'm not saying slavery stopped everywhere, but in millennia, multi-millennia, we are the nation that stood up to stop slavery. Now, when a certain race of people has been enslaved for millennium, there's a lot of bitterness and hard feelings and unanswered questions and lashback. And, you know, we've got to understand. We look at it now in terms of our culture as being wrong. But what we don't understand is that prior cultures, it was right. Doesn't make it right, but it's just hard. We cannot judge a culture 200 years ago based on our culture today. And we do need to be thankful that the United States of America was the one country that did contribute to the hypothetical end of slavery. 700,000 men's lives were technically lost in related causes, related cases, related arguments around the Civil War. There's debates about what affected what and what the South and North believed and all that. But technically, blood was shed, a lot of it, to protect slaves from being in bondage. And so I think rather than making it a black versus white issue, I think we need to make it a people, we the people versus the state or government issue, because that's where the real change still needs to be made. And that's where I personally believe that we're seeing an infiltration of control and power that is very destructive and very threatening to our entire existence. So, what else do we got? I want to talk a little bit about finances today. I'm going to. We have, you know, the White House leaking stuff, which is something I could probably talk about. That's another story I guess I won't get into here today. There's some interesting theories on who the most likely leaker is. I was reading some stuff about that. Like I said, I won't necessarily get into it. yeah, probably not. But anyway, so what we'll do is we'll talk about finances a little bit. I'll say that right now there's some of the most respected experts in our entire industry recommending numismatic coins right now. The last time they did this was the 90s, and that's about when I got into the coin market, and I didn't know any better. And when I got in, everybody was like, oh man, you better stay away from those. They, you know, because in the late 80s, everybody'd gotten into the coin market, all these stockbrokers and Merrill Lynch and Kidder Peabody and whoever else, and they pumped numismatic coins through the roof. People who are around for that might know, might remember. It was nuts. It just went crazy. So then the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, came in and said, okay, we've got all these stockbrokers selling coin portfolios. We need to regulate this industry. Well, the coin industry said, no, you're not going to regulate us. That's the whole point of why we do what we do. We're unregulated. We are a truly free market. We're not letting you in to regulate us. Well, all the stockbrokers that were selling all these coin portfolios were like, no, we want to keep selling this stuff, but we're just going to have to let it be regulated. And the coin market said, no, get out, go away. So in a very short period of time, we lost all the big brokers that were pushing the portfolios. So obviously the price of those items went down pretty rapidly. But they were so overpropped, overshot, overpriced beyond anything you could ever imagine. So it made it appear that in the 90s, coins had really bottomed out. And that's when I really got into it. I didn't know any better. Everybody's like, oh, that's too cheap. Those are down. Oh, you can't buy that. It's this, it's that. And I didn't know any better. I was a collector. I was just hoarding the stuff up, accumulating it, loving it. I was buying collections from people that no one else would touch. And I didn't know any better. That's the whole thing. Being naive sometimes is a wonderful place to be. And so as I accumulated more and more and more of this stuff at really good values, the coin grading became very strict, which is what's happening now. And also the coin grading services became stringent, which now to find coins that were graded back in the 90s is a desire because they know that things were graded very conservatively. And they have what we call crackouts where you can take them out of the holders from the 90s and get an upgrade, which in some coins is a lot of money. So we're back at that time again. And what's interesting is the market runs, and there was an article done in the 90s by a man I respect. He wrote an article for the American Numismatic Association magazine, and he showed that coins actually run in 10-year cycles, but 10 years up, 10 years down, 10 years up, 10 years down. While the 90s was, the mid-90s was the bottom, the mid-2000s, around 2007 was the peak. Some say nine, five to nine, whatever, seven was the peak. And then 2017 was kind of a bottom. I mean, 2016, 17, 15, whatever. We hit kind of a bottom. Now we are seeing a very steady, pleasant climb in numismatic coins. They've been, you know, weeded out. The pricing is adjusted. And there's just some really great values. I mean, it's mind-boggling, to be honest with you. I was talking to employees before I came up here on certain coins, MS65, $20 Liberties, that someone ordered that are, you know, they're 20-some hundred bucks a piece in their Mint State 65 gem museum quality $20 Liberty coins, and they're in the mid-2000s. The crazy thing about that was just 10 years ago, they were $5,000. And, or more. And so this is the market we're in. This is why I so vehemently encourage people to buy numismatic coins as part of a portfolio. One mistake I'll admit is, you know, getting caught up when the precious metals, when the bullion boom was running, getting caught up in it against my better judgment. We did build a lot of portfolios, but we got a lot of people coming in just demanding gold and silver bullion because it was running hard and it was a quick, easy way to make a fast profit, which is fine if you know when to get out and you know when to secure it with numismatic coins, which luckily we did for a lot of people. But now the value is just tremendous. And so what we recommend is a balance of everything because technically gold and silver is cheap. Right now, it really is, relative to recent highs. It's very cheap. Silver, you know, was in the upper 40s at the peak. Now it's in the upper teens. Gold was nearly 2,000 an ounce. Now it's in the 1,200 range. So all of them. Now gold, now silver, sure, it's got more upside. Silver's more volatile. It's going to perform better number to number. But it's more volatile. It's not as easy to track. It's not as easy to liquidate. Gold is more of a steady, constant wealth, securing, capitalizing type of an asset. In other words, it preserves your wealth more steadily. Silver is going to bounce more. It's good to have it all. But I will say, you want balance. And that's where we're at now. We preach balance. We want you to have numismatic, semi-numismatic, bulk, survival. We want you to have bullion and $20 gold pieces and Morgan silver dollars. And we just like balance. We like that. We know that's what's going to produce best for you over the long haul. And that's what our portfolios look like now. And it's basically the product of experience and wisdom. Everyone knows diversity is wise. Now, the problem with diversity is you can get an improper term of diversity. Like they'll tell you that buying stock, a bunch of different stock, is diversification. The truth of the matter is the stock market is propped up big. The indexes are big, big. But you have to ask yourself this. Is it more likely to go up or go down? I'm not going to tell you there's not some climb left in that market, but I will tell you that there's so much money stretching that thing out thin. And it's driven specifically by speculation that I am personally terrified of it. I mean, in all honesty, I'll say that if I believed that it was going to keep going, I felt good about it, I would encourage it. I really would. But what's interesting about these indexes is they have peaks, sharp peaks, big tanks, and long valleys. This is what I've watched over the decades in this stuff. The valleys stay forever, and the peaks are very temporary, very temporary. And the problem right now, if you draw a line from peak to peak over time, in fact, I'm looking at a chart right now, we are officially, I'm drawing a line on this thing, I mean, we're there. We are far beyond there. I can't tell you where the peak is, but I do know that every single time this thing goes up, it comes down and it spends way more time down trying to recuperate than it does up at these peaks. I also know that it's not really built on a solid asset. When you're buying stock, you're betting on man's ability to produce a profit for you under good economic conditions. Now, Trump is all hope and hype, but you know what? We haven't slowed down any of the Federal Reserve printing of money, none at all. We're looking the other way because the left, they won't even mention it now because it's part of the socialistic destruction of America. Just having that money pump, 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 it buys them votes is the way they believe it. But, you know, we had a market peak in 2000, you know, right around the late 90s. And we had another market peak around, what, 07, you know, so about 8 years. And then we had another market peak, kind of a little bit of a look of a peak around 2014. And then we've got this nutty rally that just, it looks purely foolish right now. It just looks reckless. I can't tell you where it's going. I just don't know. I'm not a big fan of it. I'm not a big comfort. You know, I don't get a lot of comfort out of it. But all I can tell you is if you're in it, be wise, be careful, be prepared. Every time there's an economic collapse in history, it's so unexpected. It reminds me of the tulip craze in France or whatever, where people created this huge market around tulip bulbs. And they got nuts. Well, overnight, they started to realize it couldn't be sustained. It required more and more and more money to hold it up. And I believe this is where we're at right now. And I wish I could tell you otherwise. I don't try not to just be biased. I'm trying to be reasonable. But I just don't see a reason. The economy's not doing that great. I mean, we're kind of recuperating a little bit. I love now that they're showing some economic growth. They're saying, oh, it's not Trump. It's finally that Obama's, all of his hard work is paying off and catching up. You know, it just, they never ever quit, do they? You know, they're taking full credit, even though the day, you know, to the day of inauguration and to the day of certain speeches, you can see the market turnaround for Trump. So if you're really believing in that stuff, just be very careful, very wise. If you want to do what I believe is biblical and conservative and wise, then you want to build true assets, true wealth. Thus, the name of the show. The name of the show is True Wealth. Now, here's the way I look at it. In the time that's left in the show, the world's political and economic situation really began correcting in 2001. I just always say, I want you to think post 9/11. The world, there's this huge division, chasm that created on 9/11 that changed the times we live in from times before. There's no similarities. Okay. The current path, our central banking fiat currency system, people don't realize, is in complete and total control of just about everything that goes on globally. They are propelling the globe towards some type of an imminent economic and financial collapse at an exponentially increasing pace. Every dollar is borrowed. Okay, there's no such thing as asset-backed currency. It's all backed by debt. And then you got to borrow more debt to pay the interest. It just makes no sense. It's debt stacked on debt. And that's about as simple as I can put it for you. There, it's really not based on work power, work energy, nothing like that. And so the whole system is driven sheerly by debt. When you secure your assets or wealth or whatever you want to call it in hard assets, when you secure your wealth in hard assets, you know what you have. And I've obviously done this for decades. I was a regional manager for B of A. Obviously, I worked my way up in banking. I've just done a lot of stuff with finances. And I just know that people who secure their wealth in hard assets end up doing incredibly well. People that have it in speculative paper do not. Some get lucky and jump off the bus when things are high, but otherwise they always take a bath. The thing with paper is you really have nothing. It can go up and up and up and up and up, and when it comes down, it's over. When businesses collapse, it's over. And, you know, I could see, and you could probably see one day when all of a sudden something happens with Apple and overnight it dissolves and it's over. And just the whole world just sees this massive economic meltdown for whatever reason. I can't even tell you why, but there's all kinds of reasons, patent infringements and all kinds of stuff. So it's what's important is to realize that those things that are biblically attributed as true wealth, gold and silver based assets, livestock, real estate, human life, precious stones, namely precious metals based assets, have always remained the pinnacle form of wealth in every civilized society throughout written human history. Are we so much smarter now, or have we just temporarily deviated? You have to ask yourself that. Precious metals based assets are not to be viewed as an investment. Investments involve the risk of 100% loss. Some people say, well, how do I know gold and silver is going to maintain its value? The only way you know that is if you believe the Bible. The Bible tells us from beginning to end, it's there. The Bible tells us on the final days of wrath, people will cast their gold and silver in the streets because it won't buy them salvation. The Bible tells us there's gold all over heaven. Gold was good enough for the second temple of Solomon. God told Solomon, and he's told the Israelites time and time again, get all the gold and silver, he says, for I own it all. It's all mine. So it's important to him. It was the first thing given to Jesus when he came on the earth, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. There's something about it. Coins matter to God. Our government and world banks have suppressed the precious metals prices since the mid-1800s. They've had the Bland-Allison Act and all kinds of things. So when we take that into account and calculate an inflation adjustment from historical values before pre-suppression, I'll call it, before gold and silver were manipulated, gold needs to exceed about $12,500 an ounce, and silver would be up words of $700 an ounce just to return to the comparable buying levels maintained over the previous 1,000 years. Where that may confuse you is the fact that we've got so many Federal Reserve notes out there that keep pumping out. And we think, you know, what's good must keep going. And it just doesn't work that way. Nothing will last like this, folks. There's things in the Bible God says they'll last, they'll last. Man-made stuff won't make it. Our dollar has lost well over 99.5% of its spending power since the beginning of the Federal Reserve in 1913. $100 in 1913 is $20,000+ now. I mean, you have to realize that. So if you're saving money, you better be getting some serious returns to make up for that kind of a loss or inflation. Since the abandonment of the gold standard in 1971, gold, you know, from the abandonment of the gold standard till the peaks, recent highs in the markets, gold and silver both increased over 4,000% in 40-ish some years. The short term, well, some people get hung up on the metal spikes of the Hunt brothers 1980s. I won't get into that because anybody with a brain knows that was an instantaneous blip anomaly. And it was sensible. What was going on is they created the COMEX, the Commodities Exchange, along with the Federal Reserve Act, so that they could manipulate the price of metals, because otherwise everybody would say, well, heck with you. I'm going to just stay on gold and silver. Well, they manipulated the futures. They said they created the COMEX so people could hedge futures and not have to worry about this or that. The truth is, it was designed for the central banks to manipulate commodities prices so that they could discourage people from being vested in it. What we've seen now is on a global basis, we started to see some global pressure in 2011 and 12 and 13 and so on. And then we saw the central banks come in and manipulate under Obama. Obama gave them a mandate to basically rotate futures manipulation. They trade 20 million ounce contracts of metals that don't even exist, that, or the reserves are 3% of what they're trading, which if you don't understand that, don't worry about it. It's just that on paper, they can pretend that they're leveraging far more metal than even exists above ground on Earth. And they do that in order to cause shorts to manipulate the market and bring the market down. And you think, okay, well, fine. If they're doing that, then, you know, what's going to stop them? Well, what stops them is when people buy metals, and this is what happened a few years back, when the physical interest in the metals begins to grow. And then all of a sudden, they're outperforming these futures contracts. And right now, there's a lot of eyes on the stock market. So you ask yourself, should you be buying something like this? Precious metals-based assets, you have three choices. Do you buy it when it's going down? Do you buy it when it's at a bottom and it's quiet? Or do you wait until it starts going up? Well, the problem is it's creeping up. It's building up. I mean, technically, in the last couple of years, silver has gone up like 50%. And gold has gone up, you know, about 35, 40. So it's on its way up, just very steadily and quietly. It's not getting the publicity it deserves, which is fine. I'd prefer it that way because I want a little time to do my own savings. I've mentioned to explain inflation, the average home price has gone up 22,000% from, it depends on what you read, $700 to $1,100, $1,500 on Long Beach or Long Island, New York, and around the time of the Federal Reserve, 1913. And now the average home sales price in America is anywhere from $265,000 to $300,000. That's the average. And when I say Long Island, they're like $20 million. And I just use that example because that's where the highest prices came from. Anyway, point is, that's a good indicator of what's happened to inflation in this nation. So realize the consumer price index is another important shot. Consumer price index is the index used by our government that calculates and reports inflation figures. But it's now, especially from Clinton, the classic Clinton, he created it. He made it an exclusionary index so that it no longer includes food, transportation, real estate, or energy costs for the most part. The items, these excluded expenses are what you, if you're an average American consumer, what they've excluded includes 85% of your what you spend your disposable income on. These excluded expenses are what, you know, they're necessary to keep these artificially low inflation levels down. Food, transportation, real estate, energy costs. You look at those items, I know for a fact those have gone up tremendously year over year. I know for a fact they have. So if you just look at inflation rates from the excluded items, food, transportation, real estate, and energy costs, which is 85% of what you spend your disposable income on, just since 9/11, those items alone have grown between 10 and 12% in cost. That's 4 to 5 times what our government statistics keep peddling to us. Precious metals, it's just, you know, to end, kind of end the show clearly, realize that precious metals-based assets have never truly lost their value or become worthless. They're timelessly valuable. They're always desired. They always preserve and protect. You bury them, forget about them. They stay there and preserve their wealth. What else does that? They maintain their spending power globally for thousands of years. They are one of the only universal languages I've ever heard of, okay, that everyone gets and understands. In fact, people are going more and more towards it rather than away from it. Technology is not making them more comfortable going away from it. People are getting much more comfortable going back towards those basic assets. Those are timeless, early, you know, primitive assets. They make good sense. The amount of above-ground gold and silver has remained relatively static throughout history, per man, woman, and child, and we're out of time again. But just remember, they're universally recognized and accepted anytime or anywhere in the world. We specialize in portfolios of just building. People buy and they hold. So thanks for tuning in. Go to the website, coinsplus.com, and take care. God bless, and I will be back on Wednesday. Bye-bye.